People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and we're on the road to Seattle with our guest, Dr. David C. Corton.
Basically, I set out as a young graduate to bring the lessons and skills of Western capitalism to bear in ending poverty in the third world. And after some 30 years of working on that, became aware that somehow it just was not working, that we had a few people who had access to all sorts of modern conveniences and goods and so forth, but for most people, things seem to be getting more difficult.
And Professor Doreen Stavinsky.
A person who worked as a lawyer for Monsanto for many years conveniently made his way into the Food and Drug Administration and was responsible for developing the Food and Drug Administration's policy on the labeling of genetically engineered food. He's since left the Food and Drug Administration and is now counsel for Monsanto again.
That, plus our featured commentary on People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Nicole Trejo returns in December. At the end of November and into the first week of December, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, will hold its ministerial meeting in Seattle, Washington, in the United States of America. Delegates and ministers from around the world will meet in the Convention Center in the King City to discuss possible future trade agreements like the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. Meanwhile, outside, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators are expected in Seattle, Washington, to express their opposition and displeasure with what will be happening in the so-called Millennium Round of the WTO meetings. We're joined on this special Road to Seattle broadcast of People's Tribune Radio by Professor David C. Corton of the People-Centered Development Forum, the Positive Futures Network, and author of the books When Corporations Ruled the World and the Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism. Dr. Corton, let me ask you a question. How does a Harvard MBA type Stanford graduate business school kind of guy who used to be with USAID find himself being the founder and president of the People-Centered Development Forum?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but basically I set out as a young graduate to bring the lessons and skills of Western capitalism to bear in ending poverty in the third world. And after some 30 years of working on that, became aware that somehow it just was not working, that we had a few people who had access to all sorts of modern conveniences and goods and so forth, but for most people, things seem to be getting more difficult, harder, more deprivation, more poverty, and so I set about to try to deconstruct our ideas about development and its institutions to figure out why that was happening and what might be the alternatives that would work better for people and the planet.
One of the ways that you worked to deconstruct what was happening was a book that you wrote, When Corporations Ruled the World.
Basically, it takes a look at how we've structured our institutions in the world or restructured them to make our most important decisions about our priorities, about how we use the world's resources, about employment, and so forth. And it's really about the rise of the global corporation as the governing institution of the planet. And then drawing back on both, my real-world experience, our current experience, and my business school education to understand the nature of the corporation as an institution and how, because of its nature being owned and controlled by the global financial markets, how those who work in corporations come under incredible pressure to ignore all human values other than short-term financial profits.
We're really in, I think, a battle for the future here between developing a system that's going to work for people as compared to developing a system that's going to work for a few people at the very top of the heap.
I agree, absolutely. Part of what's happened is we've moved ahead with various trade agreements under NAFTA and GATT and World Trade Organization. We've been removing the relevance of national borders. Now, what that really does is limits in considerable ways the ability of governments to set boundaries on corporations, to enforce antitrust, to set meaningful regulations on working standards, the environment, and so forth. And so increasingly, the power of the corporation extends out beyond any kind of human accountability. The other problem, of course, is that the financial system has also become integrated internationally, and we have less ability to regulate that. Now, in the midst of all of this, in the trade agreements, the organizations like the World Trade Organization are pretty much controlled by corporate interests. So what we find they're doing is kind of writing a constitution for the world, which is based on the premise not of of the sovereignty of the person, the living person, the citizen, but rather the ultimate rights and sovereignty of the corporation to go wherever it can reap the largest profits. Since the corporations have so much control over our media, we're constantly hearing all these messages about how friendly they are to people and to the planet, and how this kind of expansion will lead to universal prosperity and so forth. But of course, that's all public relations. It's the same stature as the claims that you're. This dishwasher soap will make your dishes sparkle better. Well, it sounds good, but there's not much substance behind it because the concern of the corporation is not with preserving the environment or with providing jobs. It is with making the maximum possible profit for its shareholders.
I'm looking at some statements about the book, The Post-Corporate World: Life After Capitalism, and these two in particular really strike me. It says here there's a deep chasm between the promises of the new capitalism and the reality of social breakdown, spiritual emptiness, and environmental destruction this economic system is leaving in its wake. And then, as I'm reading here, it says, capitalism is a pathology that commonly afflicts market economies in the absence of vigilant public oversight. Since the economy internal to a corporation is a planned economy, the current consolidation of economic control under a handful of global corporations is a victory for central planning, not the market economy.
Yeah, isn't that ironic?
It really is. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, basically, you take a very simple statistic that if you take a list of the world's largest economies by their GDP, gross domestic product, and then you take a list of the largest corporations by their sales, which is essentially a measure of the size of the economy they control, and you meld them together, you come out realizing that something on the order of 51 of the 100 largest economies in the world are economies that are internal to corporations. And a market economy is comprised of small enterprises that are competing against each other on price and quality and so forth in a local market. These, of course, are economies that are internal to these massive global corporations that are, in which central management is responsible for planning the activities, for setting transfer prices, for deciding where plants will go, who will be hired and fired, all for the purpose of maximizing short-term shareholder benefit. So what we end up with is a series of centrally planned economies, but without any pretense that they're being centrally planned for the benefit of the whole of society, but rather they're being centrally planned for the roughly 1% of the world's people that have some consequential participation in stock ownership.
We're working our way towards the WTO ministerial meeting in November, and I know I'm going to be there, and I believe you're going to be there,
Absolutely.
Too. You know, what do our listeners do, the people who are out listening in the audience, who are, you know, hearing what you're saying and saying, you know what, the way things are going really don't seem to be in the interest of the majority of human beings on the planet. What do we do to try and help steer this towards a more people-centered economy?
Well, we have to, first of all, we'd welcome all your listeners up here to Seattle to participate in the demonstrations and let our politicians know that they're you know, that they're way out of line with the values and understanding of their constituents, who believe that the democracy and community and the environment and decent working conditions are far more important than the so-called free trade. But I think we also have to organize, and I'm very excited by the extent to which many of the labor unions are mobilizing around these issues, and also we're seeing many of the religious organizations, the churches and so forth, that are looking at their roles in relation to these issues of economic justice and democracy. And I think this is terribly important because while we're limited in what we can do as individuals, the key is to get organized, and of course our two of our important organized constituencies are the churches and the labor unions. We also have to open ourselves up to real questions, to thinking, rethinking a lot of basic assumptions. And of course, my book, The Post-Corporate World, one of the most basic points it makes is that we need to recognize that when we talk about the publicly traded limited liability corporation, it's essentially a modern version of the British Crown corporations that were created to exploit their overseas colonies. And it's an institutional form that concentrates by its nature, concentrates economic power without accountability. And we need to, we need to look at not just the question of regulating corporations, but actually getting rid of that pathological institutional form. And because there are a lot of other ways to organize business enterprises, including with real worker ownership, community ownership, where the ownership, first of all, the much smaller in size, but also where the ownership resides in the hands of real stakeholders who have an interest beyond purely short-term financial profits. People like the workers, the managers, the community members, the customers, their suppliers, and so forth. We need to do some open ourselves up to some possibilities of a very different kind of economic system that looks, as you noted, looks more like a real market economy, which is comprised of smaller enterprises that internalize their costs, that are locally rooted, and that are responding to the demands, preferences, and wishes of their local consumers.
One way to do that would be for people to get more information about the Positive Futures Network, I would assume?
Absolutely. The website, if your people are on the web, is www.futurenet.org. Or you can call them at area code 206-842-0216.
And that phone number one more time?
Yeah, 206-842-0216.
Professor David C. Corton of the People-Centered Development Forum, the Positive Futures Network, and author of the books When Corporations Ruled the World and the Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism. This is People's Tribune Radio. The growing control of the world's food supply by large global corporations is sure to be a major topic of discussion in Seattle later this month, if not inside at the millennium round of the WTO meeting, certainly outside at the various protests that will be taking place in Seattle, Washington. We're joined by Professor Doreen Stabinski, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at the California State University at Sacramento, to talk about GEOs, genetically engineered organisms. When we're talking about genetically engineered organisms, GEOs, what are we talking about?
We're talking about organisms that have had their genetic makeup, their heritable characteristics, changed by having parts of other organisms recombined with them. And so we're talking about something like a tomato that has had a gene from a flounder inserted into the tomato so that tomatoes don't get mushy when, you know, if they happen to go below freezing temperature. It's the antifreeze gene from a flounder. So those kinds of combinations, bacterial genes put into plants, human genes put into animals, viral genes put into the food that we're eating.
On the one hand, we would have these scientists who work on behalf of large corporations trying to convince the powers that be and all of us that indeed they are creating a new form of life, so therefore they own it. And on the other hand, though, and we are talking about, on some level, introducing altered organisms into our environment, and we don't necessarily know what all the ramifications of that. Can you explore both of those points?
Sure. I think it's interesting that you juxtapose those points, because, yes, in fact, they walk into the Patent and Trademark Office and they say, this is new, it's never before existed, we need to get a patent on this, and we need to be able to own this life form as if we were the inventor of it and have monopoly control over it for 20 years. And this is one way that the transnational corporations like Monsanto and DuPont, who are the leaders in the U.S., are moving to take a very firm control over the food supply. And yet, when they go into the regulatory agencies like the U.S. Department of Agriculture or the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency or the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, what they say is, these are just the same as people have been eating for millennia, and there is no need to regulate them. There are no environmental risks. There are no unique human health risks. But in fact, there are environmental risks. There's the environmental risk of, say, genetically engineering, and here's something that came to light this year. There's a corn plant that's been engineered with its own pesticide built right in. And it turns out that, well, that pesticide is targeted towards lepidopteran insects, that is, things that are butterfly and moth-like and their larvae. Well, it turns out that, in fact, the corn pollen, researchers from Cornell University found, was toxic, was lethal to monarch butterfly larvae. And so you have all these school children who, you know, have been following the monarch migration throughout their school year, now all of a sudden, you know, shocked to find out that the corn that's planted, you know, all across the Midwest, 30 or 40% of our corn supply, of our corn fields right now are planted with this, have toxic pollen, pollen that's toxic to monarch butterflies. One of the inventions that they tried was to insert a gene from Brazil nut, which has a particular quality of its protein, into a soybean in order to increase the protein content, this particular protein quality of the soybean. Well, they found that, in fact, people that are allergic to Brazil nuts were also now allergic to the new genetically engineered soybean. So there's food risks as well, and this is, you know, increasingly serious as we genetically engineer more and more of the food supply, and the federal government has said we will not label food as being genetically engineered. You've seen this amazingly, you know, quick and fast revolving door that's happening between one of the primary corporations involved in this, which is Monsanto, and the U.S. government. And it seems as if the U.S. government can't do anything to stop Monsanto's inventions and to stop their endeavors in this field, because, in fact, they are too close. They're too closely linked. You have President Clinton's U.S. Trade Representative, Mickey Cantor, who's now on the board of directors of Monsanto Corporation.
That's convenient.
Yeah, and you have, I mean, I could go through a whole list of people that have either left the Clinton administration and gone to Monsanto, or left Monsanto, gone into the administration now are back in Monsanto. For instance, a person who worked as a lawyer for Monsanto for many years conveniently made his way into the Food and Drug Administration and was responsible for developing the Food and Drug Administration's policy on the labeling of genetically engineered food. He's since left the Food and Drug Administration and is now counsel for Monsanto again. You know, one of the really scary phenomena that's been happening since maybe about the past two decades, because companies are now able to not just get what prior to 1980 was called plant variety protection. They had some kinds of legal protection over their varieties, and with hybrids, they have some kind of biological protection. But now they have even stronger protection because they can go to the patent and trademark office now and get patents on their genetically engineered corn, which means that it's illegal for farmers to save seed, and Monsanto will take you to court, that Monsanto owns those seeds for the next 20 years, and you can't save, you can't reproduce your seeds without, you know, having Pinkerton detectives perhaps coming to figure out if you're growing Monsanto seed or not. Monsanto's prosecuted or threatened to prosecute over 500 farmers over the last couple of years. And associated with this ability to patent seeds has come this sort of not merger, but accumulation mania. That is, the large transnational biotech companies, and we're talking about Monsanto, DuPont, Novartis, Dow. All of our, you know, when we think of them, we think of chemical corporations, but they are now, Monsanto is now the second largest seed company in the world, and DuPont is the first largest seed company in the world because they've gone out and they've purchased seed companies left and right, each of them spending over $8 billion in the last couple of years to buy seed companies. This is why I say these transnational corporations are getting this huge, very firm grip on our food supply because they're going for the jugular. They're going for patents, they're going for the seed companies, and they're prosecuting farmers who are saving seed.
It seems to me that so often these private corporations turn around and patent various things. In this case, we're talking about genetically engineered organisms. But that very often the case is that the original research was paid for and done in public universities by public monies, and then somehow or another these corporations latch onto this, and then they take it for their own. I would assume that this case would be no different than so many other cases, correct?
No, this case isn't any different, and part of that comes from a statute that was passed, a law that was passed by Congress in the mid-80s called the Bayh-Dole Act, which mandated transfer of technology from public research institutions and using public funds to the private sector as a means of invigorating the private sector and getting inventions out there. But you have companies like Monsanto making research alliances. Monsanto, you know, through its subsidiary Calgene, has had a very long research alliance with UC Davis. Novartis, another large agrochemical corporation, went to the University of California at Berkeley, handed them $25 million, negotiated an agreement to basically have access to whatever research they wanted out of a particular, they made an agreement with a particular department at UC Berkeley. And they have first exclusive licensing arrangements on whatever research they want that comes out of that department. So consumers should know that anything and everything that contains soy or corn right now probably is a derivative of at least some genetically engineered soy and corn. That is, anything that has soy lecithin, soy oil, high fructose corn syrup, you know, you name it, look on the label, and if it's got soy or corn, you're eating genetically engineered food, unless, of course, it's organic. Right now, organic is the home of GE-free in the U.S. until we have labeling. Unless, of course, the corn
there's always an unless.
Pollinated by the corn from the neighbor's field next door, right? Because then that, you know, you have the potential for that biological pollution of pollen from genetically engineered fields non-GE fields.
So does that mean if the GE corn cross-pollinates with your corn that Monsanto now owns their corn and your corn or something like that?
Monsanto's actually suing a farmer in Canada who, the farmer asserts that he didn't purchase any Monsanto seed and that his seed that Monsanto, that the genetically engineered plants that Monsanto found in his field were actually biological pollution. They came there from some other neighboring field, but Monsanto is still suing him anyway.
This is scary because, of course, I said that as a joke.
Yeah, and no, then what Monsanto's happens? Reach is long. They want to have control over as much of the agricultural industry as possible, and they're doing it through genetic engineering.
Many of the guests on People's Tribune Radio, like Professor Doreen Stubinsky, are available for speaking engagements through Speakers for a New America. And now, our featured monthly commentary from Brooke Hagerty of the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo.
From offices to the shop floor to food lines, people all over America are being drawn into a struggle for the moral life of the country. Morality is an inner compass which guides not only the behavior of individuals, but determines what is and what is not acceptable within a given society. In a system of private property, morality is defined and shaped by the ruling class, which derives its wealth from the particular configuration of property relations and which holds the power to guarantee its continuation. Morality is enshrined within laws, social institutions, and ideas which permeate that society. Yet it is not simply imposed. Morality could not play its role if people did not accept it, internalize it, and use it to guide their sense of right and wrong. Notions such as it's a dog-eat-dog world, some people are more deserving than others, or more profoundly, human beings are only worth their ability to work, are moral precepts that express the underlying relations within capitalism. They serve to render acceptable the animal-like existence of the system and all the social ills that arise from it. History shows that it takes a change in the underlying relations of society for ideals to fundamentally change. These periods of history are usually times of great social upheaval, reflecting society's turmoil as it struggles to reestablish its bearings. Under such conditions, a new morality arises, one that reflects what is new and developing in society. The moral crisis of America that we hear so much about is really a crisis of the capitalist system itself. The labor-replacing technology of electronics is permanently separating millions from productive work, rendering them, in capitalist terms, worthless. All of society is being torn apart as the inability to live by selling labor comes into conflict with a society in which there is no other means of survival. Capitalist morality can only sanction the further devaluation of human life. We can see this in the relentless campaign to render acceptable the absolute destitution and even death of those who are now considered worthless. Such a moral position affects more than the destitute. It debases the whole of society. We must see this morality for what it is, a system of values that protects only the interests of the ruling class. The same thing that is destroying society is the very thing upon which we can build a new world. Electronic production promises the possibility of real abundance, a world in which all can share in the fruits of society. Under these conditions, how is it possible to have a morality that dictates anything less than that all human beings are equal, worthy, and precious, and that it is society's responsibility to nurture and protect them? This is our class morality. It separates us from the immorality of the capitalists and reorients our inner compass to the future, to the real possibilities, to not only the survival, but for the first time, the full blossoming of humanity.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. If you'd like more information about the League, our Speakers Bureau, or how to order our newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, you can contact us at 1-800-691-6888. 1-800-691-6888. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, Brooke Hagerty, and Nicole Trejo, I'm your host Mike Thornton, and we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.